Action.
Yes.
Boom in.
Boom in.
We're going to boom in.
All right, so I'm going to call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this May 18th. And I'm going to, here we go. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill, on Senate Bill 231A, and ask Senator Steiner Haywood.
Okay. Did you want to wait and come with your panel?
Oh, it's up to you.
No, why don't you kick it off?
It's up to...
Why don't you join us as well? He's got to leave shortly, so...
Yeah, I'm supposed to be chairing my committee, so my co-chair is...
You guys have trivial things to do. Go do it. Please start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Haywood, State Senator from Senate District 17. Senate Bill 231 comes to you both from the Health Authority and from work done by a range of stakeholders. It was sort of a companion bill to Senate Bill 690, and we decided to proceed with Senate Bill 231. The basic principle is this. International studies, both in the United States and around the world, have proven that investment in primary care is the best way to achieve what we call in the trade the triple aim, which is improving the quality of health care delivered, improving health care outcomes, and lowering costs. And we all talk about this a lot. But we know that investing in primary care is one of the ways to do that. And that doesn't just mean paying doctors more. That means having the resources in primary care offices that allow the kind of wraparound services that some of the more complex patients need. Over the past several years, Oregon's been at the forefront of the patient-centered primary care home, or PCPCH, movement, which includes a set of standards for these homes, quote-unquote, which are really medical practices, that are better than any other in the nation by a long shot. There are other standards, but these ones from Oregon are universally recognized as the best.
Oh, yeah.
Because they really do take the best interests of the patients to heart. And what this has been allowed to do under the Collaborative Primary Care Initiative has been supplemental payments to practices that are certified through the state's PCPCH program to provide these supplemental payments to support things like case management nurses or social workers in practices. These services don't get billed for, but these supplemental payments pay for them, and we know that we keep people out of emergency departments, we reduce hospitalizations, we reduce repeat hospitalizations, we provide optimal care when we can provide these wraparound services. So Senate Bill 231 looks to figure out a way to continue to understand the role of paying primary care and how we pay primary care in the context of both commercial and Medicaid insurance. And what it would do is to require the health authority to define what primary care really is and then have both commercial prominent is the term we use in health insurers, the largest carriers in the state, including PEB and OEB and Providence and Moda and Cambia and I can't Pacific Source. I could keep LifeWise. I could keep going, but and the CCOs to report on the percentage of premium that they spend on primary care. And we just want to get a baseline. We just want to have some sense about what's going on, what percentage of premium is being spent on primary care. We don't know what the right number is, Mr. Chair. We don't know whether the right percent is 5% or 15% or 50%. But we do know that we start to see improved outcomes as spending goes up on primary care as compared to subspecialty care or hospitalizations or things like that. So we want to get a baseline, and that's what this bill is intended to do. The one other thing that this bill does, which I think is very important, is it creates a voluntary collaborative among insurers, both CCOs and commercial insurers, with the health authority and other interested stakeholders to begin to discuss alternative payment methodologies. We know that fee-for-service is not the best way to pay for health care, and in fact, it incentivizes the wrong kinds of health care delivery. Instead, we know that finding new ways to pay for health care that focus on health outcomes, that focus on these wraparound services that I've described to you, rather than just you get paid when you have a patient sitting across from you in the exam room, is the right way to move forward. And yet we don't know, there's not one right way to do this. There are a lot of different alternative payment methodologies, and we need to have an opportunity to discuss it. However, historically, insurers have been hampered in their ability to have these collaborative conversations because of antitrust regulations. And this bill would remove that regulation solely for the purpose of this work group's work. And the intention is that it would only remove the antitrust exemption for, would only create an antitrust exemption for time spent in the work group or in communications around this work that could be considered public record. It would not include a phone conversation among two members that's a private conversation. It wouldn't include written emails that were just between one or two members. It would include emails for the work group. It would include the actual meetings that the work group held. It's a very limited exemption that would allow them to have frank, open conversations about new ways to approach paying for healthcare services, ways that would incentivize delivering healthcare in the right ways rather than old-fashioned ways that don't actually help us reach the triple aim. Controlling healthcare costs is one of the most critical things that we can do, but we cannot do that by sacrificing quality. We believe that it's possible to both improve quality and reduce costs, and Senate Bill 231 is one of the ways that we think we can start moving toward that goal. Thank you for your time and allowing me testimony. I'll be happy to take any questions.
We're going to hear some testimony about about the antitrust exemption, and would it be my understanding that if that exemption needs to be actively monitored by the state, that the meetings that this would cover would be open to the meeting? Open to the public, under public information.
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair. That certainly was my intention, that these be subject to public meetings laws, and that they be open and frank conversations. I have no desire to... It's nice to see you, Representative Kenny Geyer. Welcome back. Sorry, Mr. Chair, but it's just nice to see my colleague back.
It is nice to see you.
Yeah, that's what I think, too. We've had these conversations. She doesn't listen very well. With all due respect, Representative. Mr. Chair, my intention is personally, and I believe the health authority's intention and the other proponents, is to have these meetings subject to public meetings laws and have the communications among the group members subject to public records laws. And as I said, the only communications that would be covered are those that would be covered by public meetings or public records laws. Anything that would be considered a private communication, even if it was related to the group, the work the group was doing, by my perspective, should not be covered by the antitrust exemption. It's a very limited exemption solely for the purpose of allowing the innovation that can only happen when you have a bunch of people sitting around who really care about this, trying to figure out some ways forward.
And would it be considered in violation of antitrust if they were all had these as open meetings anyway?
That's very unclear to us, Mr. Chair. The impression that I've gotten from insurance companies in personal conversations with representatives of the companies suggests that they believe it will. I have not gotten a legal opinion from LC or from other lawyers about this, but we wanted to be clear that as long as these meetings met public meetings law and the communications among the group met public records law, that they would be considered to be exempt. Very, very limited purpose.
It's my understanding that there's no opposition to this bill, with the exception of this question of antitrust.
That's my understanding as well. It's solely a study bill and an opportunity to start exploring some new ways to think about paying for health care.
Are there any other questions? Send us so she can go back to work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Senator Shields?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate District 22, here in support of Senate Bill 231 and the Dash 6 Amendment, which I believe is in OLIS. I'm very, very supportive of the base bill, and when we were passing this out of committee, I put on the record that I was hopeful that we would have a discussion about whether or not these antitrust exemptions and antitrust immunity was really necessary, and that I would hope to persuade you in the House to take a look at it. So I think it's time for us to take a close look at whether it's good public policy to immunize healthcare players from antitrust laws, to take a close look at whether it's good public policy to essentially immunize healthcare players from antitrust laws and thereby allow them to engage in behavior that would otherwise be illegal. That's the point of the immunization, is to immunize them from liability on behavior that would otherwise be illegal. So I'll let Keith Dabanovich, who is an attorney in private practice, who's on the phone, discuss the legal concerns. But you should also know that the Federal Trade Commission has weighed in on this bill and that antitrust exemption. I believe if it's that their testimony is not up on a list now, it should be shortly. So again, I encourage you to pass Senate Bill 231 with the Dash 6 Amendment. And I'll hand it over to Keith Dabanovich if you're ready for that, Mr. Chair.
Not yet. Okay. Not for this bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Shields.
Keith, are you still on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great.
Hi, my name is Keith Dubanovich. I am an attorney in private practice in Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you by phone. I do have extensive experience in antitrust cases, and I have also practiced for many years in the healthcare arena, so I am familiar with the antitrust laws as they apply in the healthcare field. I have no position on Senate Bill 231. I was asked, however, to share with you my understanding of the antitrust laws and the immunity provision that is part of 231A. The antitrust laws were simply created to promote competition and to punish collusive anti-competitive conduct. Sharing of information between competitors is not an antitrust violation. Indeed, it is perfectly appropriate for a gas station to drive around town to find out what the competitors' prices are. That is perfectly appropriate, and that's good competition. What the antitrust laws prohibit is collusion or agreements about pricing or agreements about market allocation or customer allocation. Now, the law does allow legislatures to immunize conduct that is otherwise illegal if the legislature believes that the social utility of the conduct outweighs the anti-competitive nature. And that's perfectly appropriate and indeed happens in a number of different contexts. I note that the U.S. Federal Trade Commission has taken a very strong position against immunity in this context. And for example, they recently addressed a letter to the New York Department of Health in a situation very analogous. There, the legislature and one of the agencies was trying to create a collaborative environment, and they felt that they were obligated and needed to provide immunity for the participants. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission wrote that the actual immunity would result in not more competition, but likely less competition, and they felt that the pro-competitive help of healthcare collaboratives were going to be defeated by granting immunity, because essentially what you would be doing by granting immunity is encouraging the harmful behaviors that would lead to increasing consumer costs without improving the quality of care. And that's the opinion of the U.S. Federal Trade Commission. I'd also add that the U.S. Supreme Court very recently, this past February 2015, addressed what's usually called the state action immunity in a case involving the North Carolina State Board of Dental Examiners. In that case, a dental board organized under state law, composed of dentists, were sending cease and desist letters to people who were operating teeth whitening facilities in shopping malls around the state. The dental board took the position that teeth whitening was the practice of medicine, and therefore these folks couldn't operate and offer teeth whitening in a mall. The Federal Trade Commission brought an action against the North Carolina State Dental Board and argued that The dental board was restraining trade and stifling competition. The dental board claimed, hey, we've got state action immunity, and the trial court, the Court of Appeals, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, you are not entitled to state action immunity. So that begs the question of under what circumstances can an entity get state action immunity? First, you have to have a clearly articulated state policy that is being advanced by granting immunity. And SB 231A has that purpose in the bill. The next thing that must exist in order to be entitled to the immunity is the state must actively supervise the challenged conduct. So what does that mean? Well, the state has to accept political accountability. State officials have to actually exercise power to review the acts of the agency or the entity. The state officials have to have the authority to disapprove of decisions made by the entity, and it has to act as if it is a state agency, meaning that it needs to comply with public meetings and public records laws. If there is not active state supervision, then the entity would not be entitled to immunity. So that's the antitrust laws in a nutshell. It took me 3 years through law school to learn that, so I'm happy to attempt to answer any of your questions if you have any.
Are there any questions of this witness? Keith, thank you very much for tuning in.
This
seems to be the only issue in this bill that we have, so we'll explore it a bit more.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to open a public hearing. We'll keep this one open. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 547A. I'm going to ask Senator Montes Anderson to join us. Anything else in this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and a little bit of East Portland. And this is a very little bill, and I must declare a conflict of interest because this could affect me if I no longer decide to be back here in, or the voters decide that I should no longer be here. But basically, it's going to allow the Board of Nursing to issue a nurse emeritus license to a certified registered nurse, licensed practical nurse, nurse practitioner, or registered nurse who is retired from active nursing. And it will allow those of us who have retired to volunteer their medical skills for no compensation in a health clinic or other setting. And I feel that we are in a time when we need to take every opportunity to use the skills of our retired nurses. Access to care is extremely important, and we do have a shortage, at least in the primary care setting. So I urge the passage of Senate Bill 547, the Nurse Emeritus Bill.
Mm. Are there any questions of this Nurse Emeritus to be? Hang around for a minute.
So this was an announcement, huh?
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 457 and open a work session on Senate Bill 547. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we send Senate Bill 547A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I'm sending Noce moves Senate Bill 547A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you please call the roll?
Yes.
Representative Clem? Absent.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative
Tanny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noce?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Motion. Aye. Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Curious. We'll get that bill on your way.
Don't spend it all in one place.
Representative Noce will be the carrier. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 547A.
Yes, Senator Bates is here.
I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 840A and invite Senator Bates to join us.
Good
had the doctors in the House here today and the doctors in the Senate. Legislative Medical Association meeting.
For the record, Alan Bates, state senator from District 3, Southern Oregon. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and especially you, Representative Kenny Geyer, it's good to see you all again. I'm glad you're back with us.
Thank you.
Good to see you. One more voice telling her she's here too soon.
And just don't push yourself too hard. Senate Bill 840 is a kind of a simple bill. It's really about getting people out of the emergency room in a hospital and getting them onto a mental health floor when it's appropriate. The way our system works in this state is that when someone comes into the emergency room who's judged to be a risk to themselves or other, an immediate risk to themselves or other, we have to get them from the ER into a treatment center, primarily in the hospital, as quickly as possible. To do that, we put a 72-hour involuntary hold on them to move them, because quite often, in fact, in most cases, they don't want to be there. But it takes two doctors to do that. And I'll give you the scenario that I was commonly involved with, still am sometimes. As chief of medicine, I'd get a call at 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the morning from the ER doc saying, I've got a patient here that needs to go, in our case, to a ward called 2 North with a psych ward. And I haven't got another doctor to sign off on this. I need somebody to sign off now, or this patient's going to stay here in the emergency room until I get another doctor to come in and review the case, see the patient, and get him out. And that can take a day or two sometimes. If you think about it, on a Saturday night, and people who are qualified to make that judgment just aren't necessarily going to be around. Nothing personal to anybody on this committee, but we don't ask orthopedists to do that. I want to know if you've got a broken leg. Otherwise, forget it. So I would go in and take care of those things as chief of medicine. What this bill allows us to do is to have a nurse practitioner do that in addition to an MD or a DO. If that person has been credentialed by the hospital to do that and has had advanced training in that area. After 72 hours, there's other things we go through, primarily assessment by the county health department or others about whether that person stay or not. But the first 72 hours is very important to these people. We don't want them stuck at ER rooms. We want them on the floor. They can get the best help we can offer to them. There are other barriers to this. Quite often they stay in the ER not because of a two-doctor hold, but because we haven't got enough beds available, enough facilities available. That's a different story. This is a simple way of moving them to a more appropriate setting and getting them help as quickly as we can.
Senator Bates, we're not talking about a full civil commitment in this case. Sorry, this is a psychiatric hold.
No.
This is a hold. Admission to a psychiatric unit.
Correct. We do involuntary admissions to hospital to protect the patient or to protect others if the person's in a dangerous situation. This is not a full admission to like the state hospital or something of that nature. No.
Are there any questions on their base?
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I think the testimony was it's a 72-hour hold, though. So it is a specific hold, but that's shorter than
after 72 hours, a further decision has to be made, and a court gets involved in that.
And this doesn't require a court action for a 72-hour hold?
No, it does not.
Have you seen the... Senator Bates, have you seen the A3 amendments?
The only ones I've been working on for the A and Gross bill, the A3 are different?
Yeah, there's some amendments that were submitted to us. So
we'll get that for another week.
Yeah, we'll get it for. I just didn't know if he had a position on the amendments.
I'll review that when I have a chance on that for the committee. I'll review them this afternoon.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. We'll hold them.
I would ask that you hold a work session until I have a chance to review those and come back to you. Is that adequate? No, I didn't know anything else been submitted. I'll take a look.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Let's keep this one going. We have two more witnesses.
Sure. Could
you please call the witnesses?
Patty O'Sullivan and Katie King.
You guys have the A3 amendments? Senator Bates, would you like to hear what Mr. Sullivan says about the A3s?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I want to thank Senator Bates for sponsoring this bill for the association. We worked on this bill for quite a while, along with another one, but this is very important to rural hospitals, to the new Unity Hospital in Portland. And what it simply does, as Senator Bates has said, is within the ORS 426, which are the commitment statutes, all through there it says a physician must do this, and once in a while it says a psychiatrist, but that's the same as a physician in those statutes. And they do the work. And it starts in the emergency room where people do get 72-hour holds, and whether after that 72 hours they go into a psychiatric unit or they are released or whatever happens. But this bill simply uses a term called a licensed independent practitioner. It takes out the word physician and puts in the word licensed independent practitioner. And at the very beginning of the bill, you can see that that definition, licensed independent practitioner, which is a federal designation or word, actually includes only two occupations, a doctor, a physician, including psychiatrist, and a nurse practitioner that is hired as a mental health nurse practitioner, basically. And so it really, in essence, just adds an NP, you working in the units and working in the ED, to be able to do that work pre-commitment. The commitment work is all done by the court and the county, with, of course, the psychiatrist and doctor's reports in there.
And what does the A3 do?
The A3 is simply Legislative Counsel Lori Freeman and I worked on this bill, and we went back and forth and back and forth, and for a while we thought we had a problem with EMTALA, and that there was a couple of places where a physician had to stay in there as opposed to an NP. And then we found that we didn't have that problem. So it simply changes those references too, so that the whole statute is now changed. That's all it does. And a couple that were missed along the way. So any questions?
Senator Bates, you want to join us again for a moment? I think that you've gotten force-fed the amendment back there.
Yeah, and I apologize for not coming and discussing them with you.
For the record, I'll make this three again. Yeah, I've just read the amendments, and they're appropriate. I'm not concerned with them at all. Just changes physician to licensed practitioner resolves the issue. I know we've gone back and forth on this a bit, and I didn't know you'd actually submitted the amendment, so I'm fine with that. It's no problem. It'll do exactly what we want to do.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon chapter, the American College of Emergency Physicians. And OSEP supports Senate Bill 840A. They participated in the Hospital Association Work Group, and this is one of the recommendations of the work group. And improving care for folks in mental health crisis that present to EDs is a priority for OSEP. Emergency department visits for psychiatric illness or addictions count for 6 to 9% of all emergency department visits. And allowing psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners the ability to perform some of these duties like involuntary two-person holds will help free up emergency department beds for folks suffering from conditions such as heart attack or stroke, and it also reduces wait time for patients. And when I originally talked to the board members about this bill, it was back in Sun River in January at the annual meeting, and one of the physicians there had said just that night at 2:30 he had had a patient that had presented and had to just stay because there wasn't a second physician to sign the order. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
And excuse me, Chair, but I'd like to add one thing. I just want to let you know that once you change this authorizes and allows this to happen. Any individual hospital that does not want to allow this to happen, just it then goes into their bylaws. So if you let them do it, then you let them do it. And if you don't want NPs doing that kind of work, then that's up to that individual hospital bylaws that the medical staff creates and approves.
Are there any questions of these witnesses? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 840 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 840A. Do we have a motion on that bill?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that the committee adopt the dash Senate Bill 840A3 amendments dated 5/12/2015.
Representative Noss moves the dash A3 amendments dated 5/12/15 to Senate Bill 840A. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Do we have another motion?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that the committee send to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation Senate Bill 840-A as amended.
Representative Noss moves Senate Bill 840A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Klein?
Absent.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noss?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. I have a volunteer for a carrier.
Yes, I will.
Representative Lively?
Okay.
Be the carrier. Close the work session on Senate Bill 840A. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 282A. Madam Administrator, what have we got here? I understand the next four bills are all Board of Nursing recommended bills. One, two, three, four bills altogether.
Correct. Senate Bill 282A prohibits an individual from using the title nurse unless the individual holds a nursing degree or certificate and is licensed to practice the profession in which the degree or certificate was earned. Left the Senate floor, 29 ayes, 1 no. No fiscal, no revenue impact, and there are no amendments on the bill, Mr. Chair.
Is there a witness?
And we have one witness. Ruby Jason?
Yes.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlee and members of the committee.
Are you going to testify on all four of those bills?
I could, or I could do it whichever way the chair would like to do a synopsis.
I open all of them, and you can testify on all of them.
Okay.
We'll open up a public hearing on 283, on Senate Bill 284, and on Senate Bill 285. Go for it.
Yes, Chair Greenlee, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Ruby Jason, and I am the executive director of the Oregon State Board of Nursing. The bills you have before you are for public information purposes. As particularly in the rural areas, as health care providers start to proliferate and different models of health care come into being, numerous individuals who claim to be health care specialists, practitioners, providers, etc., the public may come into contact with individuals that may be calling themselves by certain names. So the bills you have before you just give us title protection so that, number one, the public knows exactly what they're getting when an individual calls himself a nurse, an advanced practice registered nurse, a certified nursing assistant, or a certified medication aide. It understands that the board has jurisdiction and has the ability to discipline and take public complaints against anyone holding these titles or using these titles. For the word nurse, for example, it's become pretty ubiquitous, kind of like Kleenex. There are individuals who work for veterinary clinics who call themselves nurses. There are individuals who will call themselves nurses to solicit online health care for individuals. And at present, there is no ability for the Board of Nursing to discipline anyone who simply calls themselves nurse. The term registered nurse and licensed practical nurse are already protected under statute, but the simple word nurse is not. For the APRN title, the APRN, the Advanced Practice Registered Nurse, that is a license type, which is currently in 33 separate states, including the District of Columbia, but is not a license type here in Oregon, nor is the board looking to change the licensing types that we currently have. However, as Advanced Practice Registered Nurses do come into the state, they are using those initials because it is a nationally recognized initial, and if someone runs into someone who is calling themselves an Advanced Practice Registered Nurse, they have to know that this individual can diagnose, can prescribe, take a history, do an assessment, and take care of their basic health care needs. Whereas other individuals who have been nurses for a long time, like myself, I've been a nurse for 30 years. I have advanced certifications from a number of people, yet I am not an advanced practice registered nurse because I don't have those. I don't have that authority by the board, nor do I have the ability to diagnose and prescribe. The term CNA, this is one of particular concern to us. CNAs are a very mobile group of workers. They can perform some of their activities with patients without getting CNA certified. Individual in the public needs to know that if they do have a CNA and they have a concern about the care they're getting from that CNA, they have the ability to go to the board and lodge a complaint, and the board can investigate. A certified medication aide sometimes gets confused for the term medical assistant. They are not medical assistants because, as you know, in the state, medical assistants are not a regulated work group, whereas certified medication aides do fall under the purview of the board. So in sum, these four bills are for public protection, public knowledge, that the public knows exactly what they're buying or getting care from, and it allows the board to have jurisdiction over individuals who are not using those terms appropriately. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Are there any questions? If you hang in a moment, we have some opposition on 283. I'd like to do that. I'd like to move the other three right now.
Right now or after this testimony?
Right now. Yes. We don't have any witnesses for anything except 283, is that right?
Correct, other than Ruby.
Other than, right, okay.
Right.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 282A and open a work session on Senate Bill 282A. I'm going to do that for 282, 284, and 285. Is there a motion on Senate Bill 2?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 282A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Noss moves Senate Bill 282A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
282, I had a bill similar to this just for like when a doctor or nurse would walk in and see a patient that I tried moving a couple sessions ago, and I think this is a little bigger issue. I would actually like a little more time to look at this. I don't mind if you move it forward. I just think there's probably more that we're missing or could be doing, because right now as a patient, when I go in, whoever walks in, I don't know if it's a nurse practitioner that's there, and they seem like they're a doctor, but they're not really a doctor, and you don't really know who's in front of you because lots of times they're not wearing anything when they come in to see a patient.
But that doesn't have anything to do with this bill.
Yeah.
This bill simply says somebody can't
they
use
can't
the term
use that
nurse.
Title.
Not doctor.
Or the nurse.
The term
yeah,
nurse.
They can't use the
unless
term nurse.
Unless they're registered.
So, and then is that just any level of nurse, or how
no,
far does that go?
That's a registered nurses, and nurse assistants will be a bill in a minute. We get to advanced practice nurse in a moment with a discussion. This is simply a person can't say I'm a nurse unless they're a nurse. It's very narrow. It doesn't say anything about doctor or nurse practitioner or anything else.
So they could have the degree from anywhere, from an online school.
No, they have to be a licensed RN
for the state.
They have to be licensed and meet the criteria for license.
Okay.
Any other discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Yes.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noss?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
He didn't call the whole committee.
Oh, I told her not to call.
Please call the committee. Absent. I'm a yes. And The motion carries. I'll carry this one. Close the work session on Senate Bill 282A and open a work session on Senate Bill 284. We've heard what the bill is, Madam Administrator. Can I have a motion?
Chair Grunick, I move Senate Bill 284 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
President Hayden moves Senate Bill 284 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Klein?
Absent.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. Is there a carrier for volunteer for 284?
I'd be happy to do that.
Reps Kenemer?
Sandy will help with the note.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Kenemer will carry Senate Bill 284. Close the work session on Senate Bill 284. Open a work session on Senate Bill 285. Do I have a motion on Senate Bill 285?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 285 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 285 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on Senate Bill 285? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Klein?
Absent.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hayden, will you carry that one on the floor?
Yes.
Representative Hayden will carry 285. Close the work session on 285. Could you call the next witness on Senate Bill 283, please?
Caleb Hayes, please.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Caleb Hayes here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists here in opposition to Senate Bill 283. This bill came out of the Senate on a 29-1 vote, and that's in part because we had seen it as just as it was described earlier as title protection, and we still do. We think this there's some merit to a policy like this. However, we've seen when we raise this up the flagpole to our national folks, they noticed a pattern that at some times this has been used as a strategy for essentially scope creep, where the advanced practice registered nurse title is given to CRNAs, and then at that point in future sessions, there's advances on advanced practice registered nurse scope, which then naturally extends to certified nurse anesthetists, and that's a concern for the anesthesiologists. So we'd be happy to work with the Board of Nurses or the Board of Nursing to see if we can get an amendment that would address what they're looking for and what we're looking for here. And I appreciate having a moment to speak to the committee.
Yeah, I have a question for you. We passed some stuff on advanced practice nurses. We gave them some dispensing authority in past sessions, as I remember. What's the difference between the advanced practice nurses we were talking about and this thing called advanced practice RNs?
In Oregon, there are four separate types of license types for nurses who can prescribe and dispense and diagnose patients, and that is your nurse practitioner, your certified registered nurse anesthetist who can prescribe limited prescription with no dispensing authority, and your CNSs, your clinical nurse specialists, and in some subsections also your nurse midwives, your certified nurse midwives.
Clinical nurse specialists is what I was thinking of that.
The clinical nurse specialist, there's two types of clinical nurse specialist, Chair Greenlake. One is one who chooses to get the extended education and become credentialed licensed and credentialed by their organization to prescribe and diagnose and treat individual patients. And then there are the clinical nurse specialists who provide education for nurses and do not have prescriptive authority and do not have diagnostic authority.
And the clinical nurse specialists are basically specialists rather than generalists. Is that, they're like cancer nurses and
that would be correct. That would be correct. They're specialized in specific patient populations.
How does this fit into that? How does this compare to those things?
Chair Greenlich and the rest of the committee, I believe what the gentleman is talking about is just the certified registered nurse anesthetists, not the clinical nurse specialists. I think that there has been a historical concern about when you start naming individuals different things, there might be scope creep. And I think that's what he is trying to say. I don't believe, if I may infer, that you're not really talking about clinical nurse specialist. Your objection is to the certified registered nurse anesthetist group.
Spot on.
You're worried about the CRNAs calling themselves advanced practice RNs, is that?
Correct.
Because you're worried if they call themselves that, it somehow will change, or are you worried about a change in their scope of practice?
It's
pretty broad right now, isn't it?
Right. It's been a pattern that has been seen across other states. For instance, in Arkansas, similar bill was recently passed, and then there was an effort to expand prescribing authority that would have also included CRNAs.
But don't the CRNAs have prescribing authority now?
Correct. In Arkansas, it would have expanded the level. Yes, in some instances.
In the last legislative session, there was a Senate bill passed that would give them prescriptive authority for 10 days. They can write a prescription for 10 days, not renewable, and only to those patients with which they have a relationship, and they do not have dispensing authority.
I see. So you're worried about that getting broader, is that right? Is there any other questions?
Thanks, Chair Greenlich. So that's our current policy, is the 10 days prescribing ability of CRNAs?
Yes, Chair Greenlich, Representative Bueller, that is what the statute currently provides.
And you think you can work on an amendment that would do what?
We'd be happy to work with the Board of Nursing to see if we can come to an agreement on a policy that is good for both organizations.
Okay, well, what? I'm sorry.
No.
President Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Stand at ease.
Let's stand at ease. Representative Widener, you were about to ask a question.
I guess.
Comment.
I'm just trying to get
my attention, incidentally, would be to hold this over and see where you all come back and talk about it later.
So in that,
go ahead.
I guess for me, because I'd like to see where we are as far as the prescriptive authority right now and where this creep might go to where we would have issues or where people would be concerned. So, I mean, I can wait and take this off record, but if you'd like to enlighten us, because it sounds like there's one group that we're focused on. I'm just wondering if that's going to be an issue for you on carving that out.
Chair Greenlich and Representative Widener, this is quite frankly the first I've heard of the opposition and their concern about wanting to work with the Board of Nursing. I will say that the prescriptive authority for the CRNAs, when we looked at the number of CRNAs that are actually applying for prescriptive authority, it's very few. Usually those prescriptions are written by the surgeon for the post-procedure issue. And that's why I believe in the last legislative session they went ahead and just made it for 10 days, not renewable. We have not heard any information from any of the nurse CRNAs that they wish to have more than what they currently have. In fact, very few of them, less than a dozen so far, have applied for prescriptive authority out of the 628 nurse anesthetists that we have in the state.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Sure.
I think we passed that last session, if I remember right, correct?
That is correct.
So it's still, and after passing that, there's been very few that have even applied for it?
Chair Greenlich and Representative Widener, as of today, yes, there are very few.
Representative Hayden?
Chair Greenlich, and this may be premature, but for Mr. Hayes, do you have any, can you share with us any language or thoughts that might bring the two sides together, or is that premature?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, I think at this point we would need to sit down with the other group and ensure that we've got language that works for them. So I suppose, yes, premature.
Thank you.
And if we don't pass the bill, somebody can now call themselves an advanced practice registered nurse. If, say, they are a registered nurse and maybe a clinical nurse specialist, I mean, they can use, you have no sanctions around this term.
That is correct. It is not considered a term that the Board of Nursing has any jurisdiction over in this state.
Okay, well, I'm going to close this work session and ask you two to see if you can come to some agreement on it. We'll reschedule this when?
Do it soon.
Probably Friday.
Monday.
No,
we can't do it Monday.
No, Monday.
Next Wednesday.
That's right. Next Wednesday. We'll reschedule this for next Wednesday. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 283. And
you want to go back? You still have a public hearing open.
I know. I want to go back.
Okay.
I want to go back to Cheryl Coombs.
That's 701A.
Do we only have one witness on that?
No, we have two. And you have a, we just need to open the public hearing.
All right. Well, let's go back to Senate Bill 231A, which is still open. And call some witnesses.
Dr. Janine Smith, Nicole Menthew.
Do we have some more?
Yeah, I'm trying to navigate. Evan Solino.
How many more do we have?
Three,
absolutely. Okay. The rest of you on the list will be the next panel.
Yeah. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Janine Smith. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the Oregon Health Authority and oversee the Office of Health Policy, which oversees our patient-centered primary care home recognition program. I think you had an overview by Senator Steiner Hayward about this bill. It was a combination effort of her legislation with that of the Oregon Health Policy Board that led to this bill with extensive discussions with the stakeholders as it went through the Senate side, with us landing on a, as you see in the bill, the directive to have the insurers and the coordinated care organizations to report the percentage of their total medical expenditures directed towards primary care. This is more than just the claims data. This was fashioned after what has been done in Rhode Island, the state of since 2008, where they were trying to help support primary care infrastructure. So some of the additional expenditures besides what you'd see in claims data would be part of that total expenditure that they would be reporting back through the insurance division, and we've had discussions with the insurance division to make that as least onerous as possible to the health plans. And then the discussion was to continue that collaborative. In this case, the original bill had it be mandatory, but in the bill that passed out of the Senate, it is voluntary and has that antitrust discussion provision in there because of the need from discussions with the health plans to have that in order to allow them to feel comfortable. We would be calling the meetings, we would be facilitating the conversation, and it would just primarily apply to the conversation in the room at the time was the intention of the antitrust.
Taking minutes and things like that.
Correct.
Will that create a fiscal?
No, that we Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, we did not put have a fiscal. We thought that we could manage that through the patient-centered primary care home program staff with partnership with the insurance division. So I don't know if you have a specific question since you had a pretty lengthy discussion.
Let's hear the testimony.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Nicole Merrithew, and I'm the director of the Patient Center Primary Care Home Program. At this time, I don't have any additional testimony to provide other than what Dr. Smith has provided for you, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have as well.
Thank you. Dr. Smith.
Yes. For the record, my name is Evan Salino, and I'm the immediate past president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, an organization with over 1,500 members, about 80% of all family doctors in the state. Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 231 today. Right before this, I was working up in my clinic in southeast Portland. Representative Kenny Geyer has been out there to visit just kind of the southeast part of her district out towards taking care of patients out towards Representative Kemmer's district. And I was working with residents, so new doctors who were, they finished medical school, about to go out into the real world and be real doctors. And, you know, it was a usual day in primary care family medicine practice, 15-month-old well child checks for vaccines and developmental screening, that sort of thing, 95-year-old patients, putting in IUDs for birth control and injecting knees and things like that.
For the 95-year-old patient?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yes, right. Not the same patients. OB patients, things like that. So that was a normal day. What was different today compared to, say, 5 or 10 years ago was, as I was talking with the resident going over their schedule, our behavioral health consultant, who we are co-located, meaning she's in my office, in the same office, as we're going over the schedule, she overhears that we're talking about one of the patients that she also sees, who's very complex, lots of different medical issues and psychiatric issues. And she comes over to offer some insight based on a visit she just had with the patient. Just after that, our nurse, who connected with the patient after hospital discharge, also overhears what we're talking about and comes over and offers some insight into what's going to be, you know, the upcoming patient visit. Those things would not have happened 5 or 10 years ago because we didn't have those people in our clinic 5 or 10 years ago. Now, that's a very exciting thing that's happened, but we are sending these folks out. These folks that I was working with today are going to graduate in about a month, and they're going to go out into a primary care world that is honestly very tenuous. There's exciting things happen, but we're holding on by our fingernails. There is a lot of excitement, but there's a lot of concern as well. And, you know, with House Bill 2009, the Oregon legislature established the Patient-Centered Primary Care Home Program, and it was tasked with constructing a framework to enable this robust model of care to be provided to 75% of Oregonians, over 3 million people, by this year, 2015. In addition to my clinical work caring directly for patients and teaching residents, I get the opportunity to go out and visit recognized patient-centered primary care homes around the state to help evaluate how this model of care is actually implemented on the ground. I've been to clinics of every size and variety in Oregon, from one provider practices to clinics in all of the largest health systems in the state. Information from clinics in Oregon and from health economists nationally demonstrates that implementing this model of care requires time, technology, staff, and significant effort. And this has increased clinic overhead by about 25%. In an interview, a family physician from Rhode Island described what it's been like to transition to this model of care in his state. He said, "For us, with incentives in place, it's worked out. We have enough to meet our needs and resources to pay a nurse." I'm sorry to say that I have not heard anything like that at any clinic I've visited in Oregon. In fact, just a few weeks ago, I was out visiting a patient-centered primary care home just outside Representative Bueller's district in Central Oregon. This clinic was amazing. It was a real Phoenix rising from the ashes sort of story. A few years ago, they lost most of their clinicians, and they were in serious financial trouble. A new CEO and medical director have worked with staff to drive forward a number of improvements to identify and meet community health care needs better. They've hired nurses to work with complex high-risk patients. They've extended the hours that are available for appointments and added a walk-in clinic. They've developed quality improvement strategies to know if they're doing a good job and where they still need to improve. They've stabilized the medical staff and have just hired 3 new providers. But the CEO shared with me that they're not financially supported to provide these patient-centered primary care services by their CCO or by other payers. These people and services they've added that they know result in better patient care are all essentially dependent on time-limited grant funding. She told me that she's made a list of who she would have to let go if they can't identify a way to financially sustain this patient-centered primary care work. She would have to get rid of nurses, medical assistants, outreach workers. They could all lose their jobs. You know, Oregon's primary care providers, family medicine and others, have risen up to meet the challenges of the infrastructure and time investments required for patient-centered primary care home innovations. Over 550 clinics are participating in this voluntary program, now caring for over 3 million Oregonians. That is incredible. That engagement is incredible. These clinics are working hard to meet the access demands of so many Oregonians who now, thankfully, have health insurance. Our Our primary care workforce is overstretched, and the primary care infrastructure has been undervalued by the fee-for-service payment system. This legislation will, first of all, provide for action and accountability so that we understand how much investment is actually going into primary care and how that changes over time. There's extensive evidence demonstrating that as health systems direct more resources towards primary care services and infrastructure, costs are lower and people are healthier. We save money and we save lives. According to recent data released from the Oregon All-Payer All-Claims database, the average that all payers spend on primary care through fee-for-service billing is in the range of 7-8% of total medical expenditures. We know from national and international data that high-performing health systems invest at least twice that much, or in some cases much more. However, in Senate Health Committee hearings on Senate Bill 231, insurers testified that they utilize alternative payment methods for direct primary care patient services, especially for PCPCH, patient-centered primary care home-recognized clinics. This legislation will allow collection of information for fee-for-service and non-fee-for-service primary care investment, which will allow policymakers and all of us to understand a more full picture of primary care investment in Oregon. At the same time, the legislation does provide, with the antitrust exemption, provides a safe forum for continued collaborative discussion between providers, payers, and other stakeholders to be able to effectively align efforts, metrics, and financial incentives. Alignment is really critical to encourage a strong primary care infrastructure and innovation in Oregon. With Senate Bill 231, this committee and the Oregon Legislature have an opportunity to reconfirm your commitment to primary care as a foundation of a health care system that works. Thank you for your time and attention to this important issue. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions to this panel? Thank you very much. Would you call the next panel, please?
Thank you.
Jay Rosenblum, Jeremiah, is it Rigsby or Bigsby? Rigsby, thank you. Jessica Adamson.
Like Eleanor.
Rigby. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jay Rosenblum. I'm a pediatrician in practice in Lake Oswego. I'm also the medical director for the Children's Health Alliance and the Children's Health Foundation. Our organization represents about 100 private practice pediatricians in 20 different clinic sites. It is a collaborative where what in an old system would have been everybody in competition with each other, we are clinically integrated in that, you know, everybody owns their own practice, but we're able to look and do quality improvement projects together. We're able to really embrace this concept of the medical home, which the concept has been around for decades, came out of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and like Dr. Salino described, it has been invaluable in really transforming the way that medicine is practiced. There is some urgency.
COPC was the...
What's that?
COPC was the form in the 60s and 70s.
Right. And it came out of the care for the complex, medically fragile children. And so the urgency is that... what has happened is the medical practices have embraced this concept of change, and they're looking to innovate. They are implementing things, like Dr. Salino said, that, you know, integrating behavioral health, dietitians, care managers. We're looking for ways to, to not just do sick care, to not just wait. I mean, because the traditional fee-for-service model was that you wait till something is wrong and then you bring them into the office and you get paid for the work that you do. That's not how we practice medicine anymore. And so what we're trying to do is we are trying to provide the access. The offices stay open late into the evenings. Many of the practices like mine are open 365 days a year. We want what we call continuity of care, which... You know, that may be jargon, but it's not just a question of where they get their care. It's knowing what is their history, what medications are they on, what problems do they have. And when they keep going to different places, you lose that continuity. This has truly changed the way that we've delivered care. It's allowed us to be proactive. and anticipate real issues, not just waiting for sickness. The current payment structure is misaligned with our efforts, and the bottom line is that the transformation is not that the transformations that we're doing are not financially sustainable under the current model. It's particularly difficult to be an independent physician in the state of Oregon. I was recently at an international conference, Institute for Healthcare Improvement, and a gentleman, the co-chair, was from Scotland. And in the introductory remarks, he was talking about medical home. And he, to this room of over 1,000 people from all around the world, he said, you know, we can't all be like Oregon. Which I looked around because if he knew how dysfunctional we really were.
Neither can Oregon, right?
Right. But you know what? We do. We have the innovation. We've got things started. We're moving in the right direction. We just need to make sure that that our payment models follow, because it truly is not sustainable the way that we're doing it. We need the access for our patients. We need to do it now, and we need to make sure that there's transparency. You know, to just keep hearing from insurers that whatever we do, it needs to be a budget neutral. Everything needs to be budget neutral, but we don't know what their budgets are. We don't know where they're spending their money. And if we want to do this kind of transformation, if we really want the practitioners on board with this and to make it so that they can stay in business, we need transparency. We need to know where they are spending their money. And I feel like we're like the clinics are doing the work. We just need the payment reform to go along with the healthcare transformation that we've been working on.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rigsby?
Yes, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Jeremiah Rigsby. I do public policy and regulatory affairs for CARE Oregon. We're here in support of SB 231 through the CCOs that we support are members in HealthShare, Columbia Pacific CCO, and Jackson Care Connect. The idea of patient-centered primary care homes are right within our mission. It's a way to be innovative to transform the delivery of primary care here in Oregon. We were part of former initiatives regarding primary care, and we'd like to be a part of the future initiatives as well, including one I think that is called out in Section 2 of this legislation that I don't believe has an exhaustive list of stakeholders that will be part of the collaborative. However, we noticed that CCOs were not specifically mentioned, and we want to make sure that CARE Oregon and other CCOs like us go on the record to be included in that list as well. We want to make sure it's the intent of the legislature to include CCOs as part of the collaborative that are going to talk about the future of primary care, patient-centered primary care homes. And furthermore, I guess to the Dash 6 Amendment dealing with the antitrust laws, I know that many of those that would be collaborating there would appreciate some of the protections from those antitrust regulations, or I should say the exemption from those antitrust regulations, and we would oppose that amendment as well. But we do support generally SB 231.
Thank you very much.
Representative Greenlake, members of the committee,
welcome
for
back.
The record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services, here today, both as a payer and as a provider. As we looked at Senate Bill 691 and 231 as they were introduced, we really wrestled internally with these two bills as an organization that really has a full look at the picture. We believe very strongly in the promise of patient-centered primary care homes. Of the 41 clinics we operate, all 41 are designated as a PCPCH, and all but two have received the highest tier designation. And we are very, very proud of the work that we're able to do, and really the full picture, as Dr. Salinas and others have talked about, that comes with being able to provide a PCPCH. As a payer, we see both in an alternative payment model and the current model that there is benefit here. And as the market moves to alternative payment models, we have to really talk about how do we make that investment in a way that is long-term and sustainable. We fully support Senate Bill 231. We believe it's an important step forward in order to get that baseline data. We are more than happy to provide that data and believe that by doing so, we can really start to look at what is the appropriate level of investment. We would say at the outset, as we engage in those conversations in the interim after we receive this baseline level of data, that it's really important to look at future investments in terms of how do we move practices further down the road towards PCPCH designation. How do we continue to make investments that really look at full range of care and not just double down on the fee-for-service model, because that does not move us forward. We really have to get to how do we look at providing full round care in a way that we can sustain the model long term, because that is going to be the key to long term transformation in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any?
Oh. Rep. Hayden.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Greenlee. On the ACH population versus the Oregon Health population, state already has a lot of the information through their encounter data, correct? Particularly for the Oregon Health population.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, that's correct.
And so what they're really looking for is to capture the other side of it, if you will. Okay.
That's correct.
Follow up?
Sure.
So have the insurance providers made an estimate on how the cost of that may affect their premiums, if at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, we don't believe that the data call is going to impact our premium as the OID and OHA figure out what they're going to define as primary care and what data they want. We don't believe that reporting that baseline data is going to cost us anything. The question of what does it look like if we start to increase that spend, that's a larger and longer term conversation about is that cost neutral, as some have suggested, or is that resulting in an additional level of investment that may come with cost. That's a conversation that this bill does not get into, but the baseline data call that this bill represents, we don't believe will add any cost to what we do.
So if I understand that correctly, you're saying you have the information, state just needs to ask for it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, yes, that's correct, and they need to decide what exactly primary care is, what data do they want and need, because there is data in the all-payer, all-claims database, but there's some additional data that we can pull as well. So what exactly they want in what form, let us know, and we'll get it to them.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 231 and carry over the work session to Wednesday. So 231 will be carried over to Wednesday. While I'm at it, let me tell you also that Senate Bill 430 is going to be rescheduled for May 27. We'll take that up as a work session on the 27th. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 231. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 710A. Madam Administrator, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 710A came to us from the Senate floor with 28 ayes, 2 excused. This requires specified entities to provide, upon request, one copy of individually identifiable health information free of charge to a personal individual, to an individual, or to the personal representative when the individual is appealing denial of the Social Security disability benefits. This declares an emergency effective on passage. Mr. Chair, this has a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
Would you call it? We have one witness?
Two witnesses, Mr. Chair.
Would you please call the witnesses?
Cheryl Kuhn and Patty O'Sullivan. I'll go get her. You can start.
Oh, okay. Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Kuhn. I am an individual who, in my work, helps disabled people who are seeking Social Security benefits. Mm-hmm. I have worked with Senator Gelser and others in the Senate on this bill and was very pleased when it passed unanimously. We are hoping that the committee will recommend do pass as well. Briefly, here is the problem. The heart of a Social Security disability case is medical evidence. If you don't have it, you're out of there, and rightly so. But sometimes that medical evidence exists and you can't get to it because it costs too much money for you to access it. And this is a problem that affects many Oregonians in their quest to see whether they are eligible. We're simply asking that, like 18 other states in the United States, including places like Kentucky, Louisiana, Tennessee, Texas, West Virginia, that we recognize that folks are at the worst moment of their lives when they are seeking disability benefits. They need the ability to do that and be fairly judged. Social Security, contrary to many people's belief, does not get medical records for people. It only does it when they first apply. If, like most folks, you are denied when you first apply, you will face a two-year process in which you are expected to regularly update Social Security on your medical situation. That means paying for your medical records, and they do charge for these even when they're electronic. My clients routinely face bills that range from $200 up to $700 for medical records. If you're disabled, that's a bar to your access to these benefits that you have paid into the system for your whole life. So we're asking that we join other states in making this available. One point I want to make, the Senate made some amendments to the bill. They weren't things I loved. As an attorney, I hope to be able to help my clients get these records, but the Senate said no, we want only people themselves to get the records. Okay, I'm interested in getting this done for disabled Oregonians, and so having talked with Senator Gelser, who chaired the committee, I stand ready and happy to accept the Senate version, and let's join these other states and give a little bit of help to disabled Oregonians. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being reasonable on that one.
Good afternoon. Again, it's Patty O'Sullivan, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And we are neutral on the bill. Our larger hospitals have indicated they already do this free. I'm not sure who's charging, but we may have some hospitals that are charging. We have already done this for the patient themselves. My understanding is that this bill will allow their attorneys to also... Personal representatives could also be an attorney. As long as they have a HIPAA release, they can get, but it's only one copy. We don't give them one and them one and them one. And they do have to have a HIPAA release, whether they're a personal representative or their attorney. And we will give updates if that's necessary and do that right now. Having worked at DHS for many, many, many years, I know how cumbersome and how difficult and how long that the Social Security process is. So on a personal note, I think this is a good bill, and we're neutral. Thank you.
Any questions of witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just Ms. Coons, again, I guess you referenced $200 to $700. That's over the entire time frame, or
that's
not
right.
An
that's
individual
that's
expense?
Post the Social Security getting your it for you one time.
Thank you for that clarification.
And Representative Kinnemer, the other thing is when the attorneys ask for it, they to this date have been charged, and then they charge Social Security and get that money back. Is what we understand, but this will stop that.
Correction. The cost goes to the client, not Social Security. Social Security will not reimburse for those, unfortunately.
At any rate, whoever ends up paying for it, and it's worse if it's the client, of course, this will stop that because we will also give them the copy if they're the ones that come for it.
Great. I will close the public hearing.
Thank you.
On Senate Bill 710A, an open work session on Senate Bill 710A. Is there a motion?
Chair Greenlick, I move Senate Bill 710A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Hayden moves Senate Bill 710A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Flynn?
Absent.
Representative Kitty Geiger?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noakes?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. The motion carries. Representative Kenny Geyer, will you carry this one?
Sure.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 710A. And open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 902. And Administrator, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 902 reinstates statute relating to the requirements for community health improvement plans that have been adopted by the coordinated care organizations and their community advisory council. This particular statute sunsetted on the convening of the 2015 Legislative Assembly. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. This left the Senate floor 26 ayes, 1 no, 3 excused. You do have a fiscal statement, but it's basically a statement of explanation. No revenue impact, Mr. Chair. No amendments. We and have three people here to testify, Mr. Chair.
Would you please call them?
Maureen Hinman, Doug Riggs, Jeremiah Rigsby.
We need after this one, we're going to do two more work sessions.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Maureen Hinman, and I represent the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance. We're a membership organization for school-based health centers around the state of Oregon. The focus of this bill is to bring together health and education reform efforts so that kids and families are getting services in ways that make sense and are not complicated. It does this by encouraging partnership during development of CCO's community health improvement plans, something that they're already developing. So this encourages partnership with children's service programs. Health status and educational attainment are inextricably linked, and it makes sense to coordinate the work of the organization that are striving to improve both. Kids need to be healthy to learn, to be successful in life, and to grow into healthy adults. And healthy, educated kids will make communities healthier in the long run. So this bill removes the sunset from previous legislation that passed in 2013, which was SB 436. It provides a foot in the door for some of the smaller but still effective programs like school-based health centers that may have a hard time getting a seat at the table with larger organizations like CCOs, which have competing priorities. It encourages an exploration of resources at a community level that can be maximized to create efficient delivery of services that will better reach families. It has opened the door, for example, for us to explore alternative payment methodologies with school-based health centers and CCOs. The Oregon Health Authority report on SB 436 reveals that the previous bill had an impact, and CCOs have indeed begun collaborating with children's programs, but there's still a lot of work to be done, especially in the K through 12 population. Your support of this bill will help ensure that this work continues, so I urge you to support this bill. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the School-Based Healthcare Network. I wanted to go through a quick little PowerPoint. This is really not just about CCOs and not just about school-based health centers. This is part of a larger effort that a variety of us have launched, including Representative Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, Representative Nathanson, and others, to talk about how we really get at the root of the challenges facing kids with high ACEs scores, kids facing childhood trauma. And so this is one of the ways that we think that we can help coordinate programs. And I'll be relatively brief because I know you've got a lot of the agenda. If you're a child or a child services provider, you face a number of organizations dealing with kids. You have seven state agencies, you've got counties, CCOs, school districts, law enforcement, and the list goes on, and this is probably only the beginning. And the challenge for many, many years has been coordinating across those stovepipes. For many years in some communities, we had effective commissions on children and families. Those are now gone, and there's really no one that stepped up into that role. And so we're trying to discuss how do we creatively get at that problem.
Many of you have already seen this slide. Janet Ahrens came in and presented it before the committee a couple months ago, but it basically talks about the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, which was a Kaiser Foundation study. It really is becoming the fundamental effort for us to be able to understand the trauma that children go through that lead to the outcomes later in life. And so the ACEs study is something that's evidence-based that's used throughout the healthcare system. It's not a panacea, but it helps us understand and be able to address the issues facing kids. This is, again, the pyramid that talks about all the things that lead to really trauma in people's lives. And what we find is that if kids are untreated, kids with challenges are untreated, they become the 20% that use the 80% of the Medicaid dollars. They become the 10% that are 75% of the criminal justice system. They become the people who are not in the workforce, not employed, and have chronic health conditions going downstream. The other thing I'd say about kids is we've discovered that kids are resilient. Even if you're talking about a kid with 6 or 7 or 8 ACEs, a kid who's runaway and homeless, you can intervene and provide supports for that child and the adults around him and make an impact. I mean, there's very good evidence that demonstrates that. So this is not a hopeless population, even if you get into kids who've had the most traumatic experiences. So what we're trying to do overall and what we're trying to do with this bill is identify what are the various programs that need to be at the table and integrate those groups. So we had 2 conferences last year, one in January and one in November. And the November conference focused on really what is one of the symptoms of everything we're talking about today, and that's chronic absenteeism. If you have a child that's been through all these issues and not gotten the proper supports and a family that hasn't had the proper supports, what you end up with at the very end of the day in a kid who's K through 12 is a kid who's not in school, or they're in school episodically. And so they are not going to graduate on time. They won't have the kind of supports, educational supports, and healthcare supports necessary to be successful. So we're talking about chronic absenteeism. A week ago, I opened the Oregonian, and on, I don't know, page A6 at the top of the fold was Oregon leads the country as far as failure to graduate kids. So our graduation rate in 4 years is 69%. That's the lowest in the country. So those are the kids we're talking about. We're talking about that 6 or 10 or 12% of kids who have a lot of these issues that have not received the proper supports, families that haven't received the proper supports, and what do you do with them? So I'll be very brief. We have lots of state goals. We have lots of obstacles. And really, the goal of this bill is to be one piece of the puzzle. CCOs are really at the center of healthcare. They've been directed to work on mental health and behavioral health and A&D. In many cases, they're working on 0 to 6. This bill asks them to join with us to work on the 6 to 18 or 6 to 21 age group. So again, this is not a solution, it's part of a solution, and it hopefully gets everyone at the table. So we appreciate you taking the time to consider it today. I think it'll make a difference, and we've already seen some of that as we've gone by. Thank you.
Chair Riggs, thank you. Mr. Rigsby?
Yes, Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, again, Jeremiah Rigsby with CARE Oregon. And CARE Oregon has long had active community support and community advisory councils that have also translated into active support and community advisory councils in CCOs. And many of our members are children and their families. We believe the work that's being done through these community advisory councils is important and informs the care that we're providing. And we also believe that this bill would allow us to continue doing a lot of that work and learning more about the ways in which children aren't progressing through school, the things that are going into their health that may not have much to do with healthcare, but have a lot to do with their environment. So we support SB 902 because we'd like to continue to do that work.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 902. Open up a work session for the purpose of discussing it. Representative Hayden, did you have something that's on your mind on this one?
Yeah, I had maybe a question for the people on our panel, maybe not.
Oh, well, let's get them back. Why don't you ask the question? We'll see who responds.
Okay. So my question is on school-based health centers. And I have before me one example. It's a checkbox system. When you register your child to go to school, it says, yes, I give permission for my child to receive services provided at the school-based health center. And then in bullet points below that, it continues saying, the consent will remain in effect until the end of the existing school year in which this form is signed, or until a revoke in consent or revoked in writing, the consent in writing. It is my responsibility to notify the school changes about legal guardianship. So my concern is probably 96, 97, maybe even higher percent of parents sign this when they register their child for school. And then that gives permission for that child to be seen in that school-based health center ongoing throughout the rest of that school year. We, through the House, just passed a bill that's going on to the Senate that with that form signed, there is no legal requirement for continued communication with the parent of any age child. And so my proposal here would be that the consent be broadened for minor children on a procedural basis. Is that something that you would be would consider?
The relating to clauses relating to cooperation of coordinated care organizations with providers of service developing plans. I don't think that's going to fall in that relating to clause of this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
It's coordinated care organization providers of services to children in developing plans. So putting an age limit there for parental notification, I think, would fit into it. But I think we'd have to talk to LC.
Well, we talked to LC, but I do not believe relating to the cooperation of coordinated care organizations is going to relate to issues around consent and child health care. We can get an LC out.
Well, we could at least ask them because, you know, you are talking about developing the procedures. My concern is the current procedure allows a blanket or a global consent signed at the beginning of the year that almost every parent does, and then with the confidential communication request, if that passes the Senate, there is no feedback to the parents.
It's not about developing procedures. It's about developing plans. Well, let's do this. Let's hold this over. We'll ask the LC whether your amendment fits in it, but my guess is it won't. Representative Kenny Geyer?
Yeah, I'd just like to ask a question of Maureen related to that. So there's parents are involved.
Let's hold this one over.
Can I ask you a question about whether you communicate with parents over medical services for children who are younger under the consent age of 15?
Mm-hmm. Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer. Yes, of course, parents are involved where the law allows. Okay. And school-based health centers follow consent laws in the same way as other clinics around the state.
Okay. Thank you.
I will close the work session, carry it over to Wednesday, and ask you to check in with the LC and see if an amendment like that would fit into the related clause.
Okay.
Thank you.
You can work with her, Representative Aiden.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to open a work session on Senate Bill 440A. What have we got here? We also have an A5 amendment, I understand.
Senate Bill 440 had a public hearing last week on the 11th. You might recall this requires the Oregon Health Policy Board to develop a strategic plan for the collection and use of healthcare data and to establish the Health Plan Quality Metrics Committee, directs the committee to develop health outcomes and quality measures for the CCOs and plans offered by Public Employee Benefit Board, the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, and to publish the data. Requires the Oregon Health Authority to give the CCOs a 3-month advance notice before changing the health outcomes and quality measures in their contracts. You have before you the A5 amendment, which gives the governor exclusive authority for appointing the members of the Health Plan Quality Metrics Committee, further identifies specific membership composition, adds the Oregon Health Authority to work in collaboration with the committee.
Do we have some motions?
Maybe.
Now I guess.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 440A.
Dated
May 12, 2015.
Thank you.
Representative Noss moves the A5 amendments to Senate Bill 440A, dated 5/12/15. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Any objection? So moved. I'm ready for another motion.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move Senate Bill 440A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 440A to the floor with a as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative
Buehler? Yes.
Representative Flynn?
Absent.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
No.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noth?
Aye.
Chair Garrison?
Aye. The motion carries. Senate Bill 440A goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a volunteer for a carrier?
I will, Chair.
Representative Buehler.
Representative Buehler is the carrier on Senate Bill 440A. Close the work session on Senate Bill 440A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 594. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 594 had a public hearing on the 6th of May. It's before us again. Specifies that the healthcare practitioner is not required to submit credentialing information to the Oregon Health Authority, and submission is not a condition of authorization to practice until OHA has established an operational electronic system, directs the authority to consult with the advisory work group, requires notice of the rule to be provided to the advisory work group and healthcare regulatory boards at least 6 months before the effective date. This requires OHA to report the implementation of this electronic system to the interim committee by October 2016, and then to the
October 2016?
Yeah, I think I might have had a typo on that. I think it's the October
15?
2015. 2015, let me just look. Yes. No, it is 2016.
2016, okay.
Yes. Mr. Chair, there's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the bill, and no amendments.
Do I have a motion?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 594 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 594 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Klein?
Absent.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Noth?
Aye.
Chair
Greenlee? Aye. The motion carries. Senate Bill 594 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Lively, will you carry that for us?
You bet.
Representative Lively is the carrier. Close the work session on Senate Bill 594. You all were very diligent today, and I appreciate it. We got through the agenda.
Can I just review what we've done?
Yeah, you can, and what we're carrying forward.
That's all I'm sorry. That's what I'd like to do. So Senate Bill 231, the work session is being carried over to Wednesday, May 20th. Work session on Senate Bill 283 being rescheduled to next Wednesday, May 27th. Work session on Senate Bill 430 is being rescheduled to next Wednesday, May 27th. And the work session on Senate Bill 902 is being carried over to Wednesday, May 20th.
I think we're going to be fine to just keep working. You're not going to be at the meeting tomorrow.
I am not. Okay. Unless you change your mind about that.
No. We are adjourned. Cedric? Or Jim Cedric?